what are you carrying out on the golf course that we can let go of? What, how are you, if you're getting angry at yourself on the golf course, is the anger coming from something else? Is it in there? Do we need to explore why you're getting so angry or frustrated? So we dig deep, and then we create goals that they want to feel. I often say, what do you want to feel at the end of the day today? When we're talking, what do you want to tell me? Like, what do you really want to tell me? You want to tell me that you played with confidence and you were so sure of yourself and you had a great time. So then we make goals around that.
In March, I was sitting in the media center at the Players Championship as Max Homa explained how the big leaps he's made in his game over the past year have been mental, not physical. I found that interesting. A few months later, after Wyndham Clark held off Ricky and Rory at the US Open, he explained how his psychologist had suggested that he play cocky on that Sunday whenever he heard cheers for other players. And I also found that interesting. As it turns out, the woman behind both of those moments is Julie Ellion, one of the tour's best-kept secrets over the past 25 years, as her often anonymous clients have racked up 150 tour wins, 26 major championships, and over $500 million in career earnings. So how and why is her style so effective? Well, it starts by throwing out the book on traditional sports psychology to begin with. Julie doesn't attack the surface-level performance issues. She attacks the personal baggage from life off the course to make life on it easier. In many ways, she's treating the root cause of self-belief issues, not the symptoms. And it all starts by her just holding up a mirror. Julie is now doing the same with Justin Thomas after Bones called her in January to help his player out of a self-belief slump. This conversation was recorded just a day after Julie returned to her home in Washington, D.C., after spending the week in Rome helping JT, Homa, and Clark navigate the roller coaster of emotions and immense pressure that is the Ryder Cup. And if Mr. Homa's putt to not lose that Ryder Cup was any indication, I think it's safe to say that whatever she is doing is working. Full disclosure, as I listened back to this conversation, I realized that I missed some obvious questions and tap-ins that I would like to have back. I appreciate all of you tuning into Mind Game over the past 2 months and allowing me to learn on the job. I will be better moving forward, in no small part, thanks to this free session with Julie Ellion, and I'm fairly certain that I can't afford the next one. Thanks for listening, everybody. Julie.
Hi, Casey.
How are you?
Great.
How was Rome?
Tons of blisters on my feet.
What happened?
Too much pasta.
Too much pasta.
Too much pasta.
Too much pasta.
A lot of red wine.
Yeah, I bet. And you just got back yesterday?
That's right.
Yesterday.
That's right.
Yeah, so you're a trooper for doing this.
It's all good. I'm fueled with my pasta.
Yeah.
Actually, I went to the dentist yesterday. The day I get back, I go to the dentist, and they say, have you been having like a lot of red wine?
I was going to say grinding your teeth. Yeah, watching some of these matches.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is your 10th Ryder Cup.
About that.
About
if
that.
If I counted.
Yeah.
I think about
that. Well, you are, as we will, I think, discover in this interview, if people haven't heard your name, I'm sure they have as of this golf season.
As but of the U.S. Open.
Yeah, maybe as the U.S. Open when the sort of floodgates open for you. Not all of your clients are sort of publicly known. Wyndham Clark was kind of one of the first to kind of wave the flag and say, you know, Julie has helped me out a lot. So,
well, I have to even correct the first, and it had, like in the old days, there was like it comes in waves, and Wyndham started the last wave.
In the new wave.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was very exciting.
I'm very grateful to be jumping on this wave. I have lots of questions. My first is that you, despite having sort of 150 tour wins, I think I read 25 majors. I don't know if that has gone up with the U.S. Open this year.
26.
And over $500 million in career earnings sort of in your stable of clients, which I hope you negotiated a good split on that.
I'm working on it.
You have not done many interviews.
That's right.
Why is that?
So my nickname on tour is Stealth. And I really do think that's helped my amazing career is staying under the radar. I would say the caddies know who I am, and they're often my referral source, which they're often more like me, and we hang. But I think it's worked to stay under the radar. And I really believe that it's not ethically correct to talk about my clients, you know, to go into real personal details. So it's a little tricky when I'm out on the golf course and I'm walking publicly, but I stick to not talking too much. And I think it's better for them, which is really what this is all about. And I think it's better for me too.
Yeah. Well, so I want to get into that because you choose not to talk about them, I think, because your approach to sort of sports psychology is a bit more holistic or in-depth. I don't know what the word you would use to describe it, but it's not your traditional sort of, these are the sort of principles of performance, go out there and do it. And I've had psychologists on this show say that when it comes to performance, there's a line that you can butt up against, and if it crosses that line, well, then they need to go see a traditional psychologist, therapist, whatever it may be.
Yep.
How is your approach different?
So my training is in counseling and psychology. So I start from the person and getting to know who they are and their lives and their families. And we talk at first about just who they are and what's going on. And then it's more specific to golf and their dreams and their career earnings and yearnings and what they've done so far and what they want to do. And I guess holistic is a good way to put it. There was once an article, we might talk about Kyle Stanley in the New York Times, and he won. And the interviewer asked him, are you working with Julie to help you be a better person so that you play better golf? Or are you having Julie work with you to play better golf so that you're a better person, a happier person? And he said the latter. And I think the former. And he's a great guy. I love Kyle, and we're not officially working together anymore. But I really do believe that helping a person know thyself is really where it starts, like an awareness of conscious and unconscious messages they're playing golf with. Mm. So it's more psychodynamic than cognitive. It's more emotional work than maybe what you think of traditional sports performance work.
Mm-hmm. And so that Kyle Stanley win was the week after
he lost.
After he made an 8, I believe,
that's
on
right.
The final hole at Torrey Pines.
That's right.
Spun it back into the water, loses. He was at a 2-shot lead or a 3-shot lead, I think. It maybe lost in the playoff.
I'm
not
remember.
Sure, but it was a devastating loss, and he bounces back and wins the next week.
That's right.
Your clients think that you're out to make them a better person. You think you're making them a better golfer, and it's sort of a big flywheel, I guess.
I absolutely think my work is to make them both. But if somebody comes to me for strictly cognitive performance, it probably doesn't stick with me. So there's a natural evolution of people, our relationship weeding out, because I really kind of work the deeper issues going on.
Sure. And so I guess somebody in your field, everyone kind of has a different, approach, a different theme of their work that runs all throughout, a different framework or pillar. How long what was the process of finding yours? Was that something you always thought might be stickier, might work better? Was there trial and error involved? Like, how do you get to the point where you say, I'm going to make these athletes better by getting to know themselves better?
So my career developed over time. And the one of the best stories about how I got started is I was on my honeymoon in Hawaii. And I had already done my graduate work. Is that right? Yes, that's right. I'm not sure. Yes, that's right. And we went to go play golf, and I had never had a lesson before. And the golf pro at the course on the Big Island in Hawaii started giving me lessons, and then he started talking to me about his life and lessons and life, and this went on for a few days. And he looked at me and he said, "Hey, how about we barter? You help me with my life, and I'll help you with my golf." So fast forward maybe 5 years, a professional golfer was referred to me for marriage counseling through a high school friend, actually someone who died in 9/11. So I credit her for my career. She referred this professional golfer to me. They came as a couple here in D.C., and we got them better. It's hard to be a professional golfer, hard to travel, hard on relationships. And then he decided to invite me out on a practice round. I think it was John Deere, And he won that week. And did it have anything to do with our work? Probably not. But a light bulb went off in me that week, and a light bulb went off in him that week. And he said, "I'm hiring you for a year. Let's do this." So that's how the whole thing got started. And then he had a good friend who was a top 10 player, saw how well this guy was doing, and that's how it's history now.
Unbelievable. Did you ever feel like, has the attitude changed around this type of approach with golfers specifically? Was it hard to convince them that you need to go this deep into themselves in order to perform better?
Well, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the caddies are often my referral source.
They're the matchmakers.
They are the matchmakers. And I also, like I said, it doesn't stick if they don't want to go deep. It just doesn't work. And they go on to one of my colleagues. And, you know, deep, what are we talking about? I even have in my practice, if I feel we're not going deep enough or I think there's something actually more significant going on, I refer to actual psychologists and therapists. So this is a unique combination between therapy and performance work. So,
all right. Well, let's kind of dig into what it looks like, you know, for some of your clients week to week.
Okay.
As they are playing, some basics. You carry what, 6 clients at a time?
6. Well, that's changed a little bit.
Okay.
Approximately 6.
Around 6?
Yeah.
And you probably...
6 professionals.
6 professionals.
On the tour. Yeah. And then I have some college players, or my model's changed a little bit. I'm trying to work because I really love my career and working, and I really love seeing somebody achieve their dreams. Mm. And so I'm trying to figure out how to talk to more people with less time. I'm trying to figure it out. But
okay. Yeah. All right, and the 3 that we kind of like know, based on what they've said in the media, is Wyndham, Max Homa, and Justin Thomas as of this year.
Yeah.
So let's just start there.
Okay.
I've heard pretty much all of them talk about your daily goals system.
Yeah.
During tournament week.
Yeah.
What can you take me through that? How that works?
Well, Wyndham is a great example of that, and they all are. I mean, today, it's Wednesday, they tee off tomorrow morning, so they'll all be texting me their goals tomorrow. And those 3 guys aren't playing this week, but my others are. And they'll text me goals such as something like confidence or free swings to specific targets, relax, enjoy. I mean, it can be anything based on our longer conversation earlier in the week. Mm-hmm. Whatever is going on for them, whatever they're feeling about this week, pressure, less pressure. Well, it's always pressure, but yeah. So I'm really into creating goals. They create them, we go back and forth, and then we debrief after the round.
Are there such thing as good goals and bad goals? Like, what's a goal you don't want to see come back, a type of goal?
Well, I remember Fluff telling me, we never say don't. So I never want a goal that has a negative, like, don't stress out, don't get angry. You know, we put it in the positive.
Mm-hmm. It's like in the yardage book, you wouldn't put don't hit it here. You would put hit it here.
That's so smart, Casey.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't quite figured out how to hit it there,
no.
But it works better.
Well,
if you frame
can
it
call
like
me later.
Yeah, okay, good.
pressure. I wanted to talk to you about that. Pressure. Where is, and specifically about the Ryder Cup, but just generally first, like, where do you see the pressure generally coming, the primary points of pressure coming from with tour players? Is it internal or is it external? Because there's just a massive, these days on tours, it seems like there's just a massive sort of workload on these players week to week. There's demands, there's obligations, there's all this stuff. Where do you think most of that pressure is coming from generally?
Gosh, all of the above. There was a lot of pressure at the Wyndham to make it into the, you know, the top, what was it, top 70, mm-hmm. where it used to be the top 125. So a lot of my clients that are in that group were feeling a ton of pressure those last three events. Mostly if somebody's talking to me, they want to be top 10 in the world, right? So they have to organize their lives around that goal. And it's hard on the road. And I know there's a lot of people out there, oh, they're flying around their private jets, they're this, they're that. But, you know, I've been on the road with the top 10, the number one in the world, and the 150 in the world. And it's hard week to week to take care of your body, take care of your family, take care of yourself. And so the pressure's both money list, FedEx points, internal, family. I had a client this morning I spoke to, and he went to his mother's birthday party, an away event, and then went to one of his best friend's wedding. So he was feeling not well prepared this week. So we talked about how actually that wedding was probably recovery. Like, when do you hang out with your best buds? So, you know, a bunch of pressure, but it's how, I guess I want to answer that back. It's individual, like how they feel pressure.
Mm. I find that based on things I've read, just even hearing you talk, a lot of it is in the framing of different emotions, right? Or different things they might perceive as, well, I'm distracted, I'm not prepared, I'm
right.
I'm out, you know, at parties and things like that. Or even there was a quote about nerves, something you said about nerves this week at the Ryder Cup, that they could be fun.
Right.
Right? They
right.
could be fun. So
right.
how much is it in, you know, the framing of our emotions or perceptions that leads to maybe just playing better or getting out of your own way?
So you'll hear this through this conversation. Everyone's unique, and my work is to really help someone discover what that is for them. Mm-hmm. So the clients that I had at the Ryder Cup, all three of them, that was a goal. Like, how do we make this fun? How do we work with your nerves to reframe them as exciting? And yeah, you might have first tee jitters, but how do you calm down and just love the opportunity playing at the Ryder Cup? And so, and this guy went to the wedding and the party. How do we make it that you're not walking into the Jackson event feeling unprepared? So it is a lot of reframing, but I'm also a believer to not lie to yourself. So he was feeling unprepared. So we talked about what does that actually mean? And, you know, we can get into how the Ryder Cup guys might have not felt prepared, but because they didn't play a lot of tournament golf beforehand. But so my work is talking about really that he was feeling unprepared, but then once we get it up and out, then we talk about reframing and how to make that work for you. Because mm-hmm. maybe that wedding was recovery, maybe mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Gotcha. What? How different is the Ryder Cup atmosphere or dynamics of pressure compared to a normal week?
I received an email from a friend this morning whom I'm actually having dinner with tonight, and he said, I want to talk about it at dinner tonight. He said he was a owner of a sports team. He's watched a lot of different sports over the years, and he said, and all his sports watching, he's rarely seen captains, coaches cry. And we saw Luke Donald and Zach Johnson cry in their press conferences. He said, what in golf makes them cry? And I've been thinking about it all day. You know, what is that? And I think the team event, the pressure, golf is so individual. And I think playing for your teammates is huge, and the weight of that and the pressure of that. But the fun of that, you know, you have buddies out there, so that's great. I think golf is so, like Max was talking about, his pants were too tight. Sorry, Max. And, you know, but it was like a metaphor about how golf can be so tight and restrictive. And I just think the Ryder Cup emotions, there's just so much built up there. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't surprised to see either captain cry.
Yeah.
For the joy and the pain.
Right. I've been trying to figure out what it is about the Ryder Cup that, and maybe you just answered it, that creates so much pressure and just nervous energy with these players, you know?
The putt is dropping not only for you,
yeah.
but we can say it's dropping for your country, which is
right.
huge.
Yeah, but that's the question, right? Is it like the responsibility, like do people feel responsible to in the team setting?
Yes. Yes.
And you know, responsible to who else?
Everybody they've always felt responsible for, and then yeah, their teammates and their captains.
Yeah. Is that something you discuss the week of, like trying to shed yourself of a little bit of that weight?
Actually, a few weeks before, mm-hmm. and actually the week of, then we start trying to channel those goals into more positive. Like, sure, we know you're feeling the pressure, but how can we make your goals about embracing all that
mm-hmm.
and being a role model and being a great teammate? What does that actually mean? Like, you might be really bummed that you just didn't have a great hole, but your teammate's in it. So how do you be a great teammate? That was on all three of their goals this week.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And something it seems like Europe does really well,
really
naturally.
Well.
Yeah.
Really well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, curious, as Max Homa is standing over a 10-footer to, and I thought he said it great on, he was on the No Laying Up podcast this morning.
Yep.
He never thought he had a putt to not lose the Ryder Cup rather than a putt
right.
to win.
Right.
Did it feel to you like this was your guy's sort of entire body of work being like put to the ultimate test? What were your emotions watching that?
I have total faith in Max Homa, and I'm not surprised of any of that went down. But then again, it doesn't matter that I have total faith in Max Homa. We need Max Homa to have total faith in Max Homa. So I've seen him do amazing work in the last few months. So I didn't even blink when I saw him do it because I knew he could do it.
Really?
Yep. Total faith. I just got goosebumps.
Yeah.
Like, I had total faith.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was that they took the unplayable, and I mean, Joe and I talk a lot or text a lot, and he's just becoming the champion that he is.
Yeah.
So
that you guys, that everyone else sees.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think he's starting to see it.
So I've heard him talk about, and he's kind of a fascinating guy because he can go from this regular, very approachable, very funny, very calm person to just an absolute killer
mm-hmm.
on the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
And then he can also has this mode where it's like, you know, he'll admit he's trying too hard or expects too much of himself and struggles with the self-belief piece.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you, and this doesn't have to be about Max Homa, but like if you have a player that's obviously incredibly talented and they're struggling with a self-belief piece, where do you start to build self-belief from? Is it results-based? Is it like, because I'll hear people say confidence, you know, like kind of follows results a lot of ways. It's hard to trick yourself into confidence. What about self-belief, or are they the same thing?
Well, so it's really the foundation of my work because, sure, results matter. Results, oh, I'm playing great golf, so I believe I can play great golf. Yet, if they're talking to me, then there's something that the results aren't there. So we're trying to dig deep and figure out what you're not believing in yourself, or how you're being super hard on yourself, or unconscious ways that you're holding on to something that you need to heal inside yourself that's keeping you from the results. So sure, it's the chicken or the egg, the results, and processing your results and what you want from your results, and then obviously the actual results, that they're winning or top tens. But you know, if they're reaching out to me, they want to be better. So the results on some level aren't there when they're reaching out to me.
Yeah, but that process of building self-belief has to start somewhere.
That's right. So I really create a place for them to have confidentiality, have a way to talk about everything that's going on, and we just start digging. We just start, you know, what are you carrying out on the golf course that we can let go of? If you're getting angry at yourself on the golf course, is the anger coming from something else? Is it in there? Do we need to explore why you're getting so angry or frustrated? So we dig deep, and then we create goals that they want to feel. I often say, what do you want to feel at the end of the day today? When we're talking, what do you want to tell me? Like, what do you really want to tell me? You want to tell me that you played with confidence and you were so sure of yourself and you had a great time. So then we make goals around that.
So you're almost reverse engineering the solution.
Oh, I like that a lot.
I like it too.
Yeah, no, that's good. I might.
Well, it's such a simple.
I could name my book that.
Yeah. I would love to. Yeah. I would love to publish it. It's such a simple concept when you think about it. But like, what, you know, it's like any sort of goal setting. What do you want to have happen, and how
that's
do you get from point A to point B?
That's right.
Instead of just like stumbling around in the darkness, which a lot of us golfers do.
That's right. And you know, I imagine we'll talk about it, but that's the crux of a lot of my work, like goal setting and taking it seriously. Like, do you want to keep repeating the same feelings that every day, and even on the golf course, disappointment, frustration, all that, or you want to change? And if you want to change, how are you going to actually change and do the work?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that, because I'm a terrible goal setter, and I think a lot of people are. I don't think a lot of people were taught how to properly set goals.
I think that's right.
Where what's too big of a goal? Where are the intermediate steps? What is the art of goal setting?
So it's different from all of us. A professional athlete might be different than you and I, but I think that's really right. Where are we taught goal setting? Maybe fifth grade, maybe not. I can't even think of, it's actually a really good point. So, and I'm not necessarily a great goal setter, but in my work, I think it's really important. So if the average 15 handicap wants to change, or a pro wants to change, well, how are we going to create little steps, little victories on how to get there? And that's just like workout goals. You know, I'm going to work out 5 times a week, and I'm going to work on my arms, and I'm going to work on my quads. It's helpful to have somebody that holds you accountable. And it's really important you hold yourself accountable. One of the things that I've noticed in my practice is we tend to make agreements with ourselves and then break them. I'm not going to dry January. I'm going to read more and watch less TV. But then you watch a lot of TV, but you don't realize you've just broken an agreement with yourself. And, you know, I say, like, if you had a friend you're going to meet at Starbucks on Wednesdays at 1 and they kept showing up Tuesdays at 2, you wouldn't trust them anymore to show up Starbucks Wednesday at 1. Well, we do that with ourselves a lot. We break agreements with ourselves a lot, and it creates a distrust, and that's a large component of what I do with my clients.
And that's a crippling sort of
terrible
thing to do, right? Like,
terrible.
That it may seem small in the moment, but I don't think that goes away.
No.
That stuff festers and grows.
It's toxic,
yeah,
actually.
It's toxic.
Yeah.
There's a book, and I think you know, sometimes you make bad agreements with yourself, or maybe they're too sort of like far-fetched. There's a great book, The Four Agreements, which is like all about boiling those down to like, okay, let's just start with four.
I actually just suggested that to Wyndham this week.
Did you?
Yeah. I have to see if he's read it.
Yeah, somebody, my a psychologist attached to my college golf team gave that to me and was just like, you just have too many you know, you've made too many promises that you can't really keep with yourself. And
I'm
so,
a
like,
big believer in that.
Let's just like start from scratch.
Yeah.
And the same goes for, you know, small things. You know, it is lying in a way, but like saying untruthful things out loud.
That's right.
Just build and build and build.
That's right.
Back to the self-belief thing. Where is the line with self-belief and self-doubt? Like, to be, as I'm sure you've been around a lot of great athletes in your time, all I'm sure had some element of doubt. This is a question I've asked on every episode of this podcast.
Okay,
and everyone has a different. Well, everyone has a different answer, and I think it's great. But there seems to be this, you know, existential tension between like, do I believe in myself enough to get the job done in the moment? And do I doubt myself enough to get up off the couch and keep going?
Mm.
So where do you see that, a healthy balance between those two things?
So somebody's got to want to change, right? So it starts with a decision that they want to change, get better. Old joke, how many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? Well, the light bulb has to want to change. So it starts with the decision you want to get better. And it's that chicken or the egg thing again. If you make a commitment to yourself and to learning about yourself and awareness to yourself, and then you do the goal setting, and then you start getting little victories, I believe that builds the self-belief. Mm. You're almost, you got to look at yourself and you got to set goals. And I believe you can heal anything that's keeping you from that self-belief. But I think you have to be willing to take a good hard look.
Yeah.
And my relationship with clients, if they're not willing to take a good hard look, like I said, you're not probably in the right place. Doesn't mean I don't have amazing colleagues who can help you. It's just a different kind of way of looking at it.
Yeah. So this idea that you're pushing is like, you're making very small sort of victories for yourself, and those just kind of compound, and you can kind of see belief follows from there. Like, it's this one, Sahil Bloom was on the show last week, and he said that, you know, no matter how bad things are going, you're one good decision away from turning the entire trajectory of that thing around.
Love that. I listened to that. I love that. I listened to the part where he said he sets his alarm at 5:30 in the morning, and that's when he gets his most work done. You know, I listen to that, and I love that so much, because if someone's, I don't know if he wakes up on his own at 5:30, but the commitment to his own growth and knowing that's when he gets his best work done, that's the kind of thing I mean. You know, if he knows that about himself. So there's nothing more loving and supportive and career building that you can do, or just for the love of golf, if you know what can get you better, commit to doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I like setting goals, like 30-day goals or 3-day goals, just some timeline that you say, I'm going to go lights out and commit to myself no matter what. And if you haven't read or meditated at Tuesday night, 11 p.m., and you said you would, you have to do it. Like, just the act of making that level of commitment is huge.
Yeah, it's everything.
Yeah.
What about your goals for your players? Like, what is your metric of success as somebody working with them, helping them through this?
Well, once again, it depends on what their goals are for themselves. I'm pretty attached, so I like to see them attaining what they came to me for the first place, and what they're trying to work on. But everybody's really different. Sure, most of my professional clients want to be top 10 in the world or whatever they are, but I'm just totally overjoyed when they reach a milestone for themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the best thing about my job.
Really. Is watching that process play out.
It's the best.
So let's then go to the U.S. Open this year. Yep. What who was the Wyndham Clark that you sort of first met, and like take me through the process of getting to LACC and like closing a major championship on a Sunday.
Wyndham and I started out, it's kind of unofficial November, but really in January, and he's a perfect example of somebody who was so frustrated with his career. And I actually heard, you know, doing my reconnaissance, that he was an incredible ball striker, and if he could get better mentally, there was no stopping him. Mm-hmm. And when I actually said that to him, and I said, you know, everybody says you're the best ball striker out here, oh, that would piss him off. He was like, I am so tired of hearing that. So he's a perfect example. It's like, okay, we're going to break these down into little victories. And we just started working religiously once a week, earlier in the week, talking about kind of bigger, deeper stuff, and then setting tournament goals. And then we debrief. And piece by piece, week by week, chipping away at what he wanted for himself and how to get there started to really happen. And the Wells Fargo, I think he'd say it, he had only mental goals for those four rounds. Mm-hmm. And he just felt way freer out there and more playful, and the self-belief, and it wasn't technical goals. Sure, he had a swing thought, but it was much more, how do I want to feel at the end of the day? Mm-hmm. And yeah.
There was a quote that he mentioned sort of immediately after about the advice that you gave him on that Sunday, which was,
what did I say?
To play cocky.
Yeah, on Sunday, U.S. Open.
Yeah, Sunday, the U.S. Open. Where did that come from? Like, why that message?
A lot of our work together has been about that self-belief, but the goals specifically, one of the goals on that Sunday was, he was playing with Ricky, and you know, everyone was pulling for Ricky. I mean, 90% of the crowd, and I knew that was going to happen. So one of the things that the goals was, to every time they yelled Ricky, you reminded yourself of your goal to play cocky. So he said he did it hundreds of times because he had many opportunities. I wanted him, it wasn't false confidence. We had been working deeply at what was stopping him from feeling that way, and how to encourage him and help him to get rid of the darker messages inside. And so when it came to Sunday of the U.S. Open, he really believed he could do it. And if he stayed in his mental lane, if he stayed on those goals, cocky was also a physical thing, head up, shoulders back. And he teed off Sunday morning, and I think he really believed he could win. Yeah. I think he teed off Thursday morning and thought he could win.
Yeah. I really like that you sort of are not afraid to encourage your players to play emotionally. Like, a lot of these are emotional sort of, a lot of people would say, you know, ego bad, you know, or, you know, sort of a double-edged sword, you know, or encourage a more stoic sort of approach. Like, yeah, you know, nothing you do today can fluster you, whatever. But playing cocky is like, you know, dropping to your knees when you hit a three wood. It's just kind of like letting it all hang out there.
Yeah.
And that's a much different message than traditionally, I think
that's right.
Gets pushed.
I think that's right. And once again, it's based on who I'm talking with.
Right.
You know, it just depends on what they're sharing earlier, that if what lane we're going to go into that way. But I think that's right.
Yeah. And it's a approach that's like, you know, that message is custom fit for the situation and environment he's going to find himself on Sunday.
That's right.
You know, if he's going out with, I don't know, I hate to do this to somebody, but Brendan Todd, I don't know, it's the first name that came to mind. It's not Ricky. It's not, Rory's not in front of him.
Yeah.
You know, you might have a different
sort of
message for the day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's us being in close contact. We're working with that.
Yeah.
We're well aware who he's paired with, what time, what he did the night before, what he's doing that morning, how his body's doing. It's we're hitting it from all angles, and certainly that who's playing ahead of him, who he's paired with, is huge.
Yeah, it's such an intimate sort of like relationship,
right?
You know, that you guys right. have to attack each tournament or situation, and it leads. And Steve Krubin pointed this out to me, to told me to go back to watch the video. But after he wins, your family's coming out on the green. And you go in for a hug, and it was a really good hug.
It was a good hug.
It was like three hugs. I saw you disengage multiple times,
yes.
And he was there.
Yeah.
So like you're in this very interesting space where you have a professional relationship, but it also seems like you really root for these people.
Oh my gosh, I remember, I think I was at Tour Championship Atlanta, and I was standing next to Foley. Sean Foley, and we were watching the client we were both working with. He was instructing, I was mental coaching, and he missed a chip to win. I'm pretty sure those were the parameters. And I like was gutted. Oh my God, I'm like, and I was like visually, internally upset. And if anyone was watching me, they could see I was upset. And he looked at me, said, "Wait, You care about that? Like, that's their karma." And he gave me a Sean Foley beautiful answer. And I went home thinking like, oh my God, I'm too attached. Oh my God, I'm gonna go down with them. This is terrible. And I talked to my supervisor like, oh my God, I'm feeling too much. And then fast forward months later, there again, Sean Foley and I are standing next to each other. Another client, guy misses a putt, and Sean Foley goes down, and he's like gutted and visually in a turn. And I'm like, oh my God, like it was such a learning for me, right?
Yeah.
So that's a long story to answer. Yeah, I'm really,
yeah,
because I want for them, you know, and that's what I said, the best thing about my career is seeing them attain their dreams, like, you know, a guy who hasn't won a major yet or wants to fly around in the private jet. You know, they have their own goals and dreams, and I'm right side by side with them.
Yeah. You and Sean Foley that would be a great podcast. He just came on the Golf Journal podcast this week.
Oh,
and,
did he?
You know, talked a lot about, he doesn't believe in positive or negative thinking. You know, it's a much more neutral school of thinking.
He's brilliant.
Brilliant.
Love him.
Yeah.
Love him.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And he once turned to me and he said, I just got what you're masterful at. And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Listening." And I thought about that a lot too.
Yeah.
I'm a good listener.
You are a great listener. Justin Thomas said you were a great listener this past week.
That's right.
You know, he said, which is, you know, transitions nicely, but he said you're very good at letting him or, you know, just him come up with solutions
yep.
to these problems.
Yep.
Talk about that, you know, creating that environment for people and why that's a better way than sort of giving them the answer.
So I can say, rattle off very typical sports psychology 101, like, you know, embrace the next shot, you know, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But I really believe we all have inner wisdom. And I think I said this when Wyndham won, I just held up a mirror. He was the magnificent one, and I was just reflecting that back to him. And I really do believe that's my job here. And most of us have the answers inside us, what we need to do to become whoever we want. And I certainly, you know, I often preface when I have something very direct to say, I'll say, you don't usually hear me saying this, but I'm going to tell you right now what to do or what not to do. But it's rare you hear me say that.
That's a break glass.
That's
in
right.
case of
and they like it. Sometimes I'll say, just tell me what to do.
Just skip to the end, Julie.
Okay, right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. No, we have to process. No, just tell me what to do. It's like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually know, but this is another caddy referral. It was the Justin Thomas
that
working
was a
relationship.
Caddy. Yes, that was a caddy.
That was a
referral.
Bones call.
That was a bones call.
Is it correct? What is unique about Justin Thomas, the competitor or player, compared to others?
Very similar to Max. I would put Justin Thomas on that last putt any day, he wants that last putt. I think that shows what a competitor he is. He would want to be chosen for that. He's got another way about him. He is one tough dude, and he's salt of the earth. Like, he is such a great person. He's a great human. So he's been a total pleasure to work with.
Yeah. You had a very, when the Sunday pairings came out, the singles matches, I was like, this is going to be a great podcast, because you had one guy who was really putting the team on his back in Max. And in the middle of that lineup where they ended up like kind of really needing that match, you had Justin, who was a captain's pick and somewhat of a controversial one at that, building up the self-belief piece again, and you're stuck into a pressure cooker.
Yep.
And then they throw your guy Wyndham in the anchor spot, and for an hour and a half, it looked like that was going to be a pretty important match. So take me through maybe Saturday night. There's a lot that happened Saturday after the round, but a lot of people in talking to before this want to know, like, does match play affect the approach to something like this? Does their position in the lineup affect the approach to something like this? How did you go about delivering that specific message for Sunday?
Yes and yes.
Yeah. Let's start with the match play piece, because I think that's interesting.
So if you know your own game, which these guys know their own game, they are aware if who they're, you know, what matching is the best for them. If they're kind of a wild loose cannon on the driver, then they might know that about themselves, whereas they might hit it really bomb it way farther. So that's an interesting choice. So it's once again knowing thyself, and match play is really it's all the same on some level. So it's really that self-belief and that killer instinct that they're going to be contribute to the team, and that's a lot of pressure. But if they can really get aware, and this is what our work was, on what they do well and really go do that and have the belief that they are going to contribute, then that's the equation for them.
They just need to know that they can contribute.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And not put the pressure on that they have to save the day. You know, just play your game, do what you're good at, and you will contribute. And it's usually how it works out.
Yeah. Match play is a weird one, because you get wrapped up into what somebody else is doing.
Totally.
And it lets you dictate your thinking and your strategy and your swings, you know.
And the caddies play a really big part in that, too, you know, in terms of the decision making and the banter back and forth and their course management decisions. It's the players aren't alone out there. If they have a unique and wonderful relationship with their caddies, the caddies are really helpful with that.
Mm-hmm. Would you ever do a show called Couples Therapy, where you do two sessions at once with the caddy and player?
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Another great idea. That's a great idea. I'm going to have to think
maybe
about
Fred
that.
Couples could host.
Oh, that's a that's a great idea. Hi, Freddie.
Yeah.
I've also thought, remember Car Talk?
Yeah.
Okay, I just think two people, maybe it could be you and me, just like people call in and ask, like, well, maybe you already know that exists, but just call in and ask, like, golf questions, like you would car questions.
Yeah.
And
Seinfeld did it, right? Or no, was it a Letterman?
No,
Car Talk
was an old...
Yeah, but somebody tried to make it with comedians. Comedians in a car getting coffee.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Similar.
Yeah.
Similar.
Just put us in a car.
Just put us in a car.
And we'll talk.
That's right.
And we'll talk.
I actually have one client I work with now, and all we do, I sit in my car and he sits in his car. It's a good office.
And that's it?
Yeah.
Yeah. How much of this do you spend on, like, you know, those are kind of big, broad themes that need to be drilled down on individuals.
Yeah.
How much of it is, like, very practical? Like, you know, how much is it talking about boring stuff like pre-shot routine or visualizing the shot or journaling, like how much of that is involved in your work?
A lot.
Is it?
Yeah. You mean the practicality of just what they're doing? We talk about that a lot. Yeah. Today I talked with somebody about their putting routine and how to have more of a feel when they're putting. And we talked about that most of the session today.
A feel.
A feel. A feel. Like a, not just all technical, like a feel.
Getting into a more creative zone?
That more of a mental focus. Mm-hmm. A lot of putting, I hear a lot of people saying, I'm going to try to make this putt, you know, and that's like the opposite of where I'm going. Like, it's more, let me go through my process, let me line up the ball, let me do what I know. If I do these 10 things, then most likely that putt will drop. And if it doesn't, I've done what I could.
Mm-hmm.
The feel that if I do everything I can, then the putt will drop is a different feeling than I'm going to try to make this putt.
Mm-hmm.
So it I talk a lot about how one feels rather than what you're trying to execute. I guess that
makes very interesting. And we're kind of skipping around, but back to the Max Homa putt. I mean, yeah. I'm sure he's trying to make that putt, you know.
Well, the trying piece.
The trying piece.
I'm a little stuck on that word, but yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing he said about that, which was great, which is that he, you know, I'm sure the world was spinning as you're taking that drop.
Yeah.
And he said that he switched into a mode where he reminded himself that he wanted this.
Mm.
Like he wanted this moment.
Right.
He wanted to be here.
Right.
Like, and now you've got it.
Right.
Is that a Julieism?
That's a Maxism, and Julie reflected it back to him.
I love that.
Yeah. But that's what it's all about. I mean, I think I said to all three of those guys, is there anything else you'd rather be doing today? You know, like this is what you're this is why you're talking to me. This is why you're working out. This is what it's all about. And like go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you believe that people can be their own mirror, or is it really, do you need someone around you to do that for you?
I think there's a lot we're talking about that people can do for themselves.
Yeah.
For sure. And I think mental health, a lot of the athletes have come forward and said, you know, this is really helpful, this has saved my life, this is what I need. I mean, I'm really happy that mental health gained more attention, and I think there's tons we can do for ourselves. On the golf course, not on the golf course. So sure, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and there is a mirror in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Seriously. No, it's like, who am I? Who am I? And what do I want to do with my life and my time? And how do I want to be better? And how am I going to hold myself accountable? For sure. Everybody doesn't have to call me.
No, yes.
Much more access to people if you need assistance, but there's tons you can do at home.
Yeah. The knowing what you want piece, I find, can be difficult at times. I think that it's easy to say you want to be a top 10 player in the world if you're in the top 25 or 50 or 100.
Right.
And you're right there. Of course, who wouldn't want to be? But as you, like, a lot of life is really complicated. And finding, drilling down into what you actually want and then how to get there is a lot harder than I think.
I think that's true.
We make it out to be.
I think that's true. And I think access is, I just said a minute ago, there's a lot more access to mental health professionals and things like that. But, you know, I want to be really careful. There's a lot of people who don't, you know, can't talk to me or somebody like me, but there is a lot they can do on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to be sensitive to that life is hard and we're busy and we're juggling a lot. And so it's tricky.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. What is your golf life personally like?
You didn't tell me you were going to ask me that.
I'm just curious because I met some friends I just learned where you play your golf in town last night.
What did Steve say about my game?
He didn't say anything about your game.
Oh.
No, yeah.
That's not good.
No, you're seen around town playing golf. Are you practicing what you preach with yourself?
What's funny is I used to have an old credential from the PGA Tour that says instructor on it. And I, for some reason, it got hung on my golf bag. And I remember we were out somewhere playing golf, like Kew or something, and I got like a gallery around me because I was an instructor. And my swing is not beautiful. I have much access to great instructors, but it's one of my favorite things to do is to play golf because, I mean, this isn't totally true. I was going to say turn off my job. That's not really true because I'm often looking at shot link and looking at scores, but I just love being outside and I'm really competitive. So I think I get so much into the competition that I actually am shutting down the rest of my life. So it's actually really enjoyable. I really love to play. So I play at Columbia,
mm-hmm.
and we play out on the Eastern Shore.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there's just a great culture of competition at Columbia.
Oh, yeah.
It's just it's tournaments and matches,
oh, yeah.
and I think the senior...
Yeah.
The senior invitational
today.
Always
something.
Always
yes,
something.
Always,
always
something.
Playing a match.
That's
I've been
right.
fleeced for many
that's
a
right.
dollar at Columbia.
Yes, that's right.
Is it what?
Sorry.
What parts about the game in your personal life do you find attractive, like as far as a mental endeavor, or is it strictly, is it an escape for you?
It's both. It's an escape just being out for 4.5 hours. You play quick at Columbia,
or they
write your name on the bathroom wall.
Yeah.
But the nature, the trees, the grass, the birds. But also, I love getting in a match. I like to play team events. I'm actually in the Kiowa member guest in a couple weeks.
Okay.
And I think we placed third last year, I think. But I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. I like the pressure on me to make a shot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You like that.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would, I see why your clients
yeah.
trust you. Yeah. You would
yeah,
see
yeah.
why you guys get along.
Yeah.
I skipping back before I get to the question I really want to get to, what you mentioned earlier that we could talk about, preparation leading into the Ryder Cup. How much of that do you think was a factor of the Europeans seemingly playing a lot?
I think it was one factor.
One factor.
Yeah. JT and Max played. I think the trip over there, like a couple weeks before, I mean, I just know the jet lag coming back from Rome got me this time. So, you know, the guys went over quickly for like 2 or 3 days. I don't know. I would probably time it differently for sure. I would put it at the end of the Tour Championship or something because they all said something. Well, Max and JT played, but Wyndham said he hadn't really played competitive golf in a few weeks. So it matters.
Yeah. How hard is it to win over there for Americans?
I absolutely 100% think we can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think things need to be tweaked a little bit.
Tweaked? Big changes or tweaks?
Tweaks.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they're all so good. Those
right.
players are so darn good.
Yeah.
And, you know... Yeah, tweaks, but lots of tweaks. Yeah, I was much more on the inner side of it this time, and I did observe quite a bit.
And there are differences, I'm guessing, culturally between
culturally,
the two teams.
Culturally, just, yeah. I mean, I'm not here to criticize. I just want to learn from it. And there's a lot of great people with great ideas.
But it is, there's so much that goes into that tournament that we just are not privy to.
Yeah.
The general public.
Yeah.
You know, and you think it's so simple. Like,
yeah.
Send out your, you know, send out your 8 in the morning, send them out in the
right.
afternoon, and then,
right.
and then beat
yeah.
each other
yeah.
on Sunday.
Oh, my God.
You know?
There was one green, I think it was, oh, geez, 13, 14 green,
mm-hmm.
where the crowd, mostly Europeans, were singing this song. I have it stuck in my head. And it was boisterous and exciting. And the spirit at that green was amazing. And they're also really smart golf fans,
mm-hmm.
like, and very respectful and get quiet when to get quiet and loud when to get loud. I think we can do it. I just think.
Is it overcomplicated? The process of the Ryder Cup? Like, is it too, do you think there's too much being, I saw that a few times, or heard that said a few times over the course of the week, but like, there's a lot of data. There's a lot of, analytical decisions being made. There's a lot of, build up to it. There's just a lot. It's just a lot. And it makes for a great viewing experience as a fan. And a lot of drama and things like the hat waving incident, but like, is it really that complicated?
Not that complicated, you know. Like I said earlier, I don't know if it was on air. I ate a lot of pasta over there, and I was reading a pasta recipe, Amatriciana, this morning in the Washington Post, and they talked about how flavors meld, and you know, you always hear about like the soup's better the next day. I just think there's some melding that needs to happen that I didn't really see. But I wasn't in the locker room.
Right.
But I don't think it's complicated. I know what you're saying. There's a lot of different angles to it. I just add a few things and you take away a few things.
Yeah.
But
there's some big things like the fact that we don't ever, as junior or amateur golfers in the U.S., play alternate shot.
Right.
That is a cultural difference.
Right.
That people over there grow up playing at their club.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
They play it as kids
on
junior teams, on junior national teams and tournaments. I mean, it is and it is a different style of golf. I mean, when you have you are playing that in itself is a mini Ryder Cup, really.
That's right.
You know, you're hitting a shot for someone else.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. My wife told me that. She played a lot of alternate shot overseas, apparently.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
So. Oh, that's interesting. I was also thinking about this morning that, I don't know, this has nothing to do with anything really, but every one of the guys on the European team speaks at least two languages. I don't know what that has to do with something, but it's just interesting, you know, that, I don't know, a lot of players over here are in a very kind of controlled lifestyle from very young age. There's something about,
we're individuals, you know.
We're individuals.
We are individuals, and I don't think it's a fair statement to say that they, you know, Americans as a whole don't work well together on a team. That's not true.
No,
especially not in the golf sense.
Great teams.
But like, it is it's a difficult thing to play for yourself all, you know, for 2 years and then transition. You know, you want to beat this guy now that you're supposed to love and cheer on.
Right.
Like you've trained yourself, woken up every day trying to beat that person.
Yeah.
Probably not liking them at some times.
Yeah.
And that's just how we're programmed.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the team atmosphere in my mind on both sides was amazing, but I think that's right. I think there's not a lot of team events over here.
Yeah.
At college. College was probably the last time Wyndham played in a team event.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And Ludwig played in one like 3 months before.
Right.
That.
So there you go.
So.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. The question I really wanted to ask you is the first time I ever talked to you, you told me that your sort of first foray into professional sports was with
the Wizards.
The Wizards in 2000 or 2001.
I'm really not good with dates.
Okay.
But around them.
Around them.
No, actually it was later than that.
Was it?
It was when Gilbert Arenas was playing.
Oh, so that was, you were not in the Michael Jordan days?
No.
Okay.
I lived here, but I was not involved. So I was a fan.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember when my first referral came to me from the Wizards.
So this was like,
it was an individual
06?
Player. There you go.
06
yeah, that
through,
makes sense.
You know, the late 2005s.
Yeah.
What was that team like to work with?
So my work was much more with individual players. I had to do like basketball for dummies because I really didn't know much. But once again, as we've discussed, an athlete is an athlete, a person is a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started with one player that wasn't performing so well. And then it kind of trickled down to a few other players. And then I did some teamwork. I don't know. I feel like I'm not educated enough on what constitutes a great basketball team. But once again, I saw some not cool stuff going down. So
you like guns in the locker room?
I came in one. Exactly. Yeah, that was on my watch, the gun in the locker room. Yep.
Interesting goals for that.
I want to sage the building. It was like there's like some ghosts in here or something. Yeah, it was a wild time. I went to all the games during those few years, and it was above my pay grade what was going down. Mm. Yeah, that gun in the locker room. I was there that day.
Were you really?
I wasn't in the locker room, but I was 10 feet from the locker room.
Did you guys have an emergency summit debrief?
I remember doing a debrief, and it's the team started getting physical with each other and, like, fighting, and I just got out of there. Yeah.
Golf. Yeah. Golf is...
Yeah, I'm just going to stick to, like, fairways and greens. Yeah.
Golf is more your speed.
Yeah.
Where do you think... transitioning out of that, where do you think, like, the state of sports psychology as a whole? Good place. There's a lot of ideas out there, a lot of good ideas, a lot of ideas that, you know, necessarily aren't for everyone.
Yeah.
Like, you've been in this business a long time. Where is it? How have you seen it evolve?
Oh, my God, it's changed. Unbelievable. So when I was going back to school, there were no sports psychology degrees, mental coaching degrees, and I went for my PsyD and tried to gear everything towards athletes and mental coaching and read things about the mind and the meditation and ideal performance states, and I just channeled everything into that. Now there's just sports psychology programs all over the world, and I always tell, like, if I meet a 20-something-year-old who's a sports person, I just tell them I have the best career in the world. Like, it's such a merging of the love of sports and mental health. And, you know, if you want to go into the sports psychology field, like I said, there's zillions of programs, but there's so much access online, too. And it's totally changed the whole career path is totally changed.
Yeah.
It's really exciting. And, you know, I heard the other day that NBA teams have somebody on staff now. I think they're required to. Mm-hmm. And I think juniors and up, you know, some of these younger kids are getting into the golf game. I think the kind of age 14 to 24, 25, those younger years, these kids are like sponges. So if you can get into their heads at an early age and start, you know, it's just like a swing. If you start developing patterns and not get a really good teacher in there, you carry those patterns, your swing mistakes forward. If you can get into a young mind, mm-hmm. and help them be goal-oriented and some of the stuff we've been talking about, it's fantastic. I mean, I'm very excited where the profession's going.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm building out my company now we're creating programs for juniors and a mental health golf school. And it's just totally exciting. And I really love the idea of working with younger people.
Yeah. And is that program, I would hope it's, I'm guessing it's, you know, geared around being more accessible for young people.
That's
because
right.
I think it's like it's been a huge barrier to entry for I mean, junior golf as a whole has gotten sort of more expensive, more competitive.
Yes.
And now the list of things that you need to really compete at the highest level has just,
yes.
gotten, like, you know, trainer,
right.
Practice access, tour,
right.
you know, touring schedule, elite junior tournaments,
right.
Equipment, and now you add, like, the psychology piece, which,
right.
is like a really it's important.
Right.
I'm sure you can do,
right.
it without it,
right.
but your,
right.
chances of,
right.
making it out of that rat race,
right.
improve dramatically.
A lot of coaches these days, I'm hearing, I have some college players, are really incorporating it into their coaching, which is great. And, you know, so I'm hearing more and more about that. And our business is trying to talk to some of those coaches. And we're trying to build that and give them more access to tools. I mean, there's golf schools all over the world, right? But there's a few I can name that are mental coaching schools, but it's a great opportunity. So
you've been around enough generations now of good young players that have come into the tour to see the skill level sort of rise each time. How much, where is the margin between players now? Is it still technical and physical as like nutrition and fitness become more of a must-have? Or is it skewing towards like all these guys can hit it well, all these guys have access to the same information? The people that get the mental piece right are the ones that succeed.
Well, I of course think the mental piece is huge. Mm-hmm. I'm a believer in hitting it from all angles. So those that choose to work on the whole pie, to me, probably have a better chance. Certainly there's people who are physically more gifted. But I guess I'm a believer in human nature, and if you apply hard work, your dreams, the self-belief, then you pretty much can compete if you really nail it from all the angles. As you brought up earlier, access. I work with the Howard University golf team here in DC, and the coach is a phenomenal human being and an incredible coach. These kids were working on access, like how to get out to practice rounds at different golf courses. But they're learning how to hit it from all angles, the mental health too. And so I guess I'm an optimist, and I believe even the high handicappers to all the people we're talking about, I think if you really work on the right things, you can get there. And sure, I could sit here and say names of people who are just like Wyndham, like an unbelievable ball striker. But it took him hitting it from all angles to start getting where he wanted to be.
Mm-hmm. How excited! That was a great sort of series they put out on Howard's golf team.
Oh my god!
On ESPN Plus.
Yeah, I haven't even watched it all.
Yeah,
just
it was great.
Great group.
And
of
how
folks.
Exciting is golf in DC right now?
Oh my god!
You know,
god.
College golf is
That's
back.
That's right. And National Links Trust.
The
is
Links
doing,
Trust is yep. is doing amazing work.
Yeah.
So it's a good time to be in the golf business in
for
DC.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Julie, I really enjoyed this. I have a lot more questions, but you just got back from Italy, so I will let you go now. But thank you for doing
thank
this.
Thank you so much. So good to talk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We'll play some golf sometime.
Yeah, that'd be great.
At Columbia.
That'd be great.
Yeah.